This week, happy Public Domain Day 2010. Works of thousands of artists get released. Record labels stop signing artists due to piracy. And New Zealand is now monitoring all of its citizens' data. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 10 for Thursday, January 7th, 2010.
And what she had done is borrowed several hundred very ordinary words of mine that weren't central to my art, you know, and just used them in this, in the, as a one small building block in the cause of making, I thought, an extraordinary work of art. You know, do we have, as writers, have we kind of overreacted to this quote-unquote crime? And are we, is it unfair to lump all acts of borrowing together? And that's what that piece is about, is trying to figure out, well, what is it wrong to take someone's words? And when is it actually totally fine, forgivable?
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last cohorts. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, your source for news on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for links to all the news stories mentioned during this show. And the opening clip was from a Malcolm Gladwell discussion on borrowing material, where some of his writing ended up in a play, unbeknownst to him, and he eventually ended up understanding and appreciating the context in which his work was built upon and changed into something new, a new piece of art. So if you want to check out the full discussion, just go to the forums and click on the link and you can listen to the whole thing. We're going to skip right to Pirate News, How Technology Killed Copyright. And this is from Kelowna.com. I'm just going to read out the first portion of this because I thought it was fairly well written and kind of interesting. It says, copyright infringement has stirred the souls of artists and publishers since the time of Charles Dickens, who went to the United States in 1842 to ask the Americans to stop pirating his works. His books were being reprinted there without his receiving a penny, but the Americans told him to jump in a lake. How the world has changed. Now America's a bastion for the defense of copyright, and the country that once rejected international copyright laws is relentless in enforcing them. However, 2009 might have marked the year when the enforcers lost valuable ground. I think 2009 was a watershed year, said David Grattan, founder of Work at Play, a Vancouver digital agency and creator of DEQQ, an online service in which artists like David Usher and Nelly Furtado connect directly with their fans. You wound up seeing industry almost give up the fight on this and realize we now need to think differently. It's not the death of copyright. I think the intellectual property that people have is going to be monetized differently. It's a fundamental change. Technology has forced the change, one in which there is no turning back. Digitization makes it possible to reproduce, copy, and disseminate material without necessarily getting the assent of the creator, just as American publishers did to Dickens. Attempts to close the door on technological advances have been largely unsuccessful, and Grattan sees the coming decade as one in which new models will take place of ones that have failed to adapt. Sousa, an American composer and conductor John Philip Sousa, was terrified of player pianos taking away business from real musicians. It was the same thing with phonographs, said Grattan, yet it led to a groundswell of new musicians and new business models growing up. Grattan sees two factors that will lead to new and innovative business models. One is people's willingness to pay for convenience. The other one is that people are willing to pay for is around experience. He said, what is the connection I have to that content? Grattan says, while people immediately think of such things as attendance at a concert or movie theater in exchange for content creators' willingness to share, those are only some examples. You're seeing a lot of experimentation on copyright materials that are being delivered in unique ways, in ways that are very experimental, he said. While the copyright debate is often seen as one with traditional stakeholders on one side and new media types on the other. And it goes on. And it's a decent read, so take a look. Probably rehashing a lot of things that you've read about or heard about before, but it's good to look at as a retrospective kind of the last 10 years of copyright and the internet. The next one, Public Domain Day 2010. Wallace McLean posts his annual list of authors whose works now are public domain. And this was, I found it through Michael Geist twittering about it. And this is off of publicdomain.zanga.com. Flip over that calendar and turn the page not only on the year, but on copyright in many thousands of works. It's January 1st. Well, a couple days after January 1st now, which means it's Public Domain Day in those countries, most of them, where copyrights run for the life of the author, plus so many years, and to the end of that year. With the largest cohort of the world's population adheres to the life plus 50 general rule of copyright. Copyright subsists in a work for the life of the author, plus 50 years, and then to the end of the year. Which I didn't know that it goes to the end of the year. I thought it was on the day. So it is actually Public Domain Day. This means that in 2010, works whose sole or last surviving author died in 1959, and for no peculiar rule of copyright term applies, have now passed into the public domain. Where their death dates governs the substance of the copyright in the life of plus 50 universe, those works authored by American rock musicians The Big Bopper, Buddy Holly, and Ritchie Valens, Anglo-American novelist Raymond Chandler, British sculptor Sir Jacob Epstein, and American architect Frank Lloyd Wright are now in the public domain. But the copyright term, like death itself, that triggers the life plus 50 countdown, is democratic. It isn't only famous authors who enjoy copyright, both during their lifetimes and posthumously, so it isn't only famous authors whose works entered in the public domain today. Unfortunately, many countries in the world have chosen, unwisely, to extend the general term of copyright to life plus 70, meaning that the critical year to consider in those jurisdictions is 1939. Published works by those authors who died in 1939 passed into the life plus 70 public domain today. They include those by the famous, such as Irish poet and dramatist William Butler Yeats, Pope Pius XI, British sexologist Havelock Ellis, American author and adventurer Richard Halliburton, and American Western novelist Zane Grey. The public domain is in the cultural property and intellectual heritage of an entire people and the entire world in which a given work is now encumbered by copyright. It's your public domain to use, adapt, preserve, promote, and enjoy. Short live copyright and long live the public domain. And he goes on to list hundreds of other works that have now passed into the public domain. Actually, the authors, not the works themselves. So go take a look at that link and enjoy all the new freedoms you have. France is forced to delay its three strikes internet law. And this is from broadbandgenie.co.uk. France has been forced to delay its controversial three strikes law set up to combat internet privacy, even though it looked like it was all going ahead as planned at the start of the year. Plans have been thwarted by France's own government data watchdog, the equivalent of Ofcom, and put on hold for the foreseeable future until it acquires detailed reports on how the legislation will be put into action. The Commission Nationale de l'Informatique et de Liberté has asked for more information on how lists of alleged offenders will be compiled. It has also demanded a better breakdown of dates and details on penalties. Until it's happy with the procedure the authorities have confirmed, they won't sign the necessary documents needed to put the law into operation. last month, internet service provider TalkTalk set up a competition to create a protest song, poem, or other form of artistic expression against a similar law being set up in the UK. Judged by Stephen Fry, a £3,000 prize will be awarded to the best entry submitted before 22nd of January 2010. And so you can find out more about that contest. And thank goodness France has delayed its three strikes law to look for the logistics behind it. Because I think a lot of these three strikes laws are being pushed really quickly through the law books and through the courts without considering what kind of impact it's going to have on the end consumer, because it could have very devastating effects on the end consumer, considering that it's not a specific user that uses an internet connection. It's just an internet connection. It's hard to tie a person to an IP address. You can tie a computer possibly to an IP address, but you can't tie a person to that IP address. It's just a connection. And in the case of places where people gather and use open Wi-Fi, maybe it's multiple people, maybe it's hundreds of people a month that use that internet connection. And one person can spoil it for that whole connection and could shut down libraries' Wi-Fi and coffee shop Wi-Fi, which will come to the devastation of even some small towns that don't have a lot of high-speed internet connections. On to privacy news from New Zealand. New Zealand's cyber spies win new powers. This is from stuff.co.nz. New cyber monitoring measures have been quietly introduced, giving police and security intelligence service officers the power to monitor all aspects of someone's online life. The measures are the largest expansion of police and SIS surveillance capabilities for decades and mean that all mobile calls and text, email, internet surfing and online shopping, chatting, and social networking can be monitored anywhere in New Zealand. In preparation, technicians have been installing specialist spying devices and software installed all telephone exchanges, internet companies, and even fiber optic data networks between cities and towns, providing police and spy agencies with the capability to monitor almost all communications. Police and SIS must still obtain interception warrant naming a person or place they want to monitor. But compared to the phone taps of the past, a single warrant now covers phone, email, and all internet activity. It can even monitor a person's location by detecting their mobile phone. All of this occurring almost instantaneously. Police say in the year to June 2009, there were 68 interception warrant applications granted and 157 people prosecuted as a result of those interceptions. Police Association Vice President Stuart Mills says that the new capabilities are required because criminals were using new technologies to communicate and that people who weren't committing criminal offenses have little to fear. However, Civil Liberties Council spokesman Michael Bott said that the new surveillance capabilities are part of a step-by-step erosion of civil rights in New Zealand. Police Minister Judith Collins responded to questions from the Sunday Star Times about the new surveillance capabilities, saying, "I support the rule of the law." In last year's budget, she approved extra police funds to subsidize companies writing surveillance devices into their telecommunications networks. The measures are the consequence of a law, the 2004 Telecommunications Interception Capability Act, which gave internet and network companies until last year to install devices allowing automated access to internet and cell phone data. Telecom, Vodafone, and Telstra Clear have earlier 2005 deadlines, and New Cellular for Providers 2 Degrees installed the interception equipment before launching last year. Official papers obtained by the Star Times show that despite government claims that it was done for domestic reasons, the New Zealand spying capabilities are part of a push by United States agencies to have standardized surveillance capabilities available for their use from governments worldwide. While U.S. civil liberties groups unsuccessfully fought these surveillance capabilities being used on U.S. citizens, the FBI was lobbying other governments to adopt them. FBI Director Robert Mueller III told a Senate committee in March of last year that the FBI needs global reach to fight cybercrime and terrorism, and that cooperation with law enforcement partners gives it the means to leverage the collective resources of many countries. Auckland lawyer Tim McBride, author of the forthcoming New Zealand Civil Rights Handbook, says our politicians had let down New Zealanders when they yielded to the foreign pressure and imported U.S.-style surveillance into New Zealand. He said monitoring email, internet chatting, and Facebook is like the police and SIS planting bugs in every cafe and park. It would probably help solve a few crimes, but the cost is too great. So, keeping in mind that a judge needs to issue a warrant to obtain this kind of information from the ISPs, do you think that it's a necessary evil to force communication companies to install these monitoring systems to catch criminals? Or do you think this is going way too far? Now, it doesn't say anything about it in this news story, whether it's a constant logging of data or whether they have to turn it on after the warrant's been issued. I suspect that they have to turn it on because that would take an enormous amount of storage to store everybody's data and every transaction that goes through New Zealand's pipes. So, do you think this is a massive invasion of privacy, or do you think that it's just a coming of the times for the police department to be able to access this data? It's copyright news from Britain. Prove piracy losses, says Digital Economy Bill Amendment. And this is sent in by DC, and it's from torrentfreak.com. In the first sitting, dozens of proposed amendments to the Britain's Digital Economy Bill started to move through the Lords Committee stage yesterday. One interesting amendment put forward requires that when copyright holders inform ISP of file sharing infringement, they must also put a value on it. Yesterday, a line-by-line examination of Britain's Digital Economy Bill took place during the first sitting of the House of Lords committee stage. There are 74 proposed amendments to the bill. In terms of file sharing, amendments are suggested to the section which obliges ISPs to inform their customers that an infringement has taken place via their account. In addition to informing subscribers who have allegedly infringed themselves or subscribers who allow other individuals to use their account to infringe, the following category is proposed. Infringement of the owner's copyright appears to have taken place through peer-to-peer file sharing networks on a subscriber's IP address. This means that all copyright infringements that occur on an IP address will be attributed to the person who pays for the account. As pointed out by Paid Content, this addition is sure to rile campaigners who protest that IP numbers do not correspond to identity. However, another amendment asks for the removal of the clause which allows action to be taken against subscribers whose connection will use to infringe copyright by someone other than the subscriber. Amendment 52, proposed by Lord Lucas, states that the copyright infringement reports sent to ISPs by rights holders should also set out the value of the infringement on the basis described in the initial obligations. This is an interesting one. When an anti-piracy company working on behalf of the music and movie industries track an infringement, it's only possible for them to track a single infringement. For example, the uploading of one track, movie, or part thereof. It is impossible for them to prove any additional infringement took place, i.e. uploading the same to others. This means that not only will the report loss per infringement be very low, but it could also force the right holders to claim that an upload to the anti-piracy company equates a lost sale. Amendment 71 from the Lord Whittier asks that for the section below to be completely removed. The number and nature of the copyright infringement reports relating to the subscriber may be taken into account for the purposes of any technical measure. Should the amendment be accepted, this suggests that taking technical measures, three strikes throttling, on a basis that the subscriber has been caught multiple times, will be disallowed. There are also amendments tabled to challenge a number of instances where the term infringement should be changed to read infringement allegations. The next sitting of the committee stage will be heard on January 12th. So it looks like there's a bit of common sense being injected into this bill, which it looks like, might be getting it watered down so far that the bill would be ineffective and probably just struck from being introduced. Because if they can't charge an individual person, and if they can only assign the loss of one movie or one track to any individual, and also that if it's alleged infringement, which it is because it has not been proved in a court of law, this bill has no teeth, which would make it a little bit easier to just strike it down and vote it away. And let's all hope for that. Privacy news from the US. FTC to examine cloud privacy concerns. Finally. This is from computerworld.com. A development likely to be closely watched by Google, Amazon, and Microsoft, and other vendors, the Federal Trade Commission is examining potential threats to consumer privacy and data security posed by cloud computing services. The agency will hold roundtable sessions on January 28th and another later this year to gather information from industry stakeholders and to study ways of protecting consumer privacy in cloud environments. The FTC plan was also detailed in a letter sent to last month to the Federal Communications Commission. The letter was filed in response to a request from comment on a national broadband plan that is being drawn up by the FCC. In its letter, the FTC said it wants to be sure that the FCC pays attention to technologies such as cloud computing and identity management in drawing up its plans. The letter, signed by David Vladeck, the director of FTC's Bureau of Consumer Protection, highlighted some of the cost benefits of cloud computing services, but also expressed concerns at the associated risks. The letter, dated December 9th, was dug up by The Hill blog, which reported the story earlier this week. The ability of cloud computing services to collect and centrally store increasing amounts of consumer data, combined with the ease of which centrally stored data may be shared with others, creates a risk that larger amounts of data may be used by entities in ways not originally intended or understood by consumers, Vladeck warned. The FTC is also considering how businesses can strengthen identity management practices, such as user authentication and credentialing, to protect consumer privacy on the internet, Vladeck wrote in his letter. The roundtable scheduled for January 28th is the second agency in holding online privacy issues. The first was held in December and focused on the risks associated with online information collection and use, behavioral advertising, and consumer expectations relating to privacy on the internet, and the adequacy of legal mechanisms. In addition to the day-long roundtable discussions on consumer privacy and data security in cloud environments, the FTC will also seek comments and original research on the topic from industry stakeholders. So this is very good news, so that the public knows what is going on with their data when they're uploading it to Google or Facebook or any of or Amazon or Microsoft, as they quoted in the story, so that consumers can be better informed and be better protected from large leaks or even from these places selling your data or monetizing your data in a way that you're not aware of or that you're not wanting it to happen, because they can bury this kind of stuff way down in the EULA when you click yes, I understand the agreement, and you don't understand the agreement, or the agreement is almost illegal to understand and agree to, where you're giving away your rights to your own data. Copyright news from the US. Sony won't support its own movie for an Oscar over misplaced privacy fears, sent in by DC. This is from TechDirt.com. One of Jack Valenti's final battles while still in charge of the MPAA was his silly, misguided war on DVD screeners. Screeners are copies of the movie on DVD that are sent out to people to view, to screen, for awards show and the like. Valenti freaked out that since these screeners were out before the official DVDs were out, they would lead people to uploading them online, creating a piracy problem. Of course, this assumed two incorrect things: that those movies weren't already online, and that adding one more copy would create any sort of problem. Valenti lost his initial battle to forbid from sending out DVD screeners, but what came next were a series of convoluted attempts to stop piracy via the screeners, including sending DVDs that could only play in special players. 2 years ago, studios finally realized how ridiculous and cumbersome this process was, so it dropped the special DVD player requirement, and instead went with a watermarking option. But that's crazy expensive. Each DVD screener now needs to be individually watermarked and tracked. Given that, it seems that some of the studios are simply deciding not to support certain movies for the Academy Awards. John Jack points out to the news that folks involved with the movie Moon are pissed off that Sony won't send out DVD screeners for the movie, as they were hoping that actor Sam Rockwell might get an Oscar nod for his part in the movie. Sony claims that it's just too expensive to do the watermarking. It's really no surprise that this comes from Sony Pictures, whose CEO, Michael Leighton, is on record as saying that nothing good has come from the internet. And then, when questioned on that statement, stands by it. So I guess that Leighton doesn't use the internet, or he would know, as pointed out in Slash Films Link, that perfectly good copies of the movie, without watermarks are widely available for download. In other words, there's no reason whatsoever to waste money watermarking DVDs. It won't make a difference. Yet, because of Leighton's and his crew's misguided fears, Sony Pictures won't support this particular movie. And what it doesn't point out in the story is that, the story's amusing in a couple aspects, two of which is that you can legally buy that movie on Blu-ray right now. For £12 in Amazon UK. You can order it on the internet right now. Yet they won't send out the screeners for fears of that it'll be copied. Well, it's already out there. And it's already being widely available in 1080p on torrent sites. It doesn't get any better out there. So they're scared of sending it out on DVD when it's already available on the internet for free on torrent sites, in a higher quality without watermarking. So what further are they afraid of happening? What are they afraid of? It's absolutely absurd, this story, that Sony won't support their own movie to possibly be able to be available to the people who are voting for it at the Oscars so that they can make more money by people going to see it in the theaters again and buying it on disc. It doesn't make any sense. But then again, it hasn't for a long time. Privacy news from the US. Facebook suggests that you lie, break its own terms of service to keep your privacy. Sent in by DC. This is from WashingtonPost.com. Here's a new one. As Facebook continues to grapple with the negative press over its privacy overhaul, it's now suggesting a new way to protect your personal information. Lie about it. At least that's what Barry Schnitt, Facebook's Director of Corporate Communications and Public Policy, told the Wall Street Journal in an article this evening. From the story, Facebook also made publicly formerly private info such as profile pictures, gender, and current city and friends lists. Mr. Schnitt suggests that users are free to lie about their hometown or take down the profile picture to protect their privacy. In response to users' complaints, the friends list can now be viewed only by friends. Of course, this directly violates Facebook's own terms of service, which stipulate that users may not provide false information. Registration and account security. Facebook users provide their real names and registration and account security. Facebook users provide their real names and information, and we need your help to keep it that way. Here are some commitments you make to us relating to registering and maintaining the security of your account. You will not provide any false personal information on Facebook or create an account for anyone other than yourself without permission. And it says, update, I've reached out to Facebook and Schnitt has clarified his position. And he says, I think WSJ is paraphrasing Wall Street Journal. When I said that his profile picture and current city are optional, you don't have to include a profile picture, or you can include a picture of your dog or anything you like. Similarly, you don't have to indicate your current city, or you can indicate that your current city is Atlantis, Valhalla, or again, anything you like. Now, keep that one in mind. We hope that people will use accurate information if they're comfortable doing so, because that information helps them to be found by friends, which is part of the point of joining the site. Facebook has always been heavily reliant on its users being honest and has thrived because of it. It was among the first social networks to mandate the use of real names rather than aliases, which has made it easier to find friends and also forces users to take more responsibility for their actions. If Facebook is actually going to start suggesting falsifying or removing information as a means to maintaining privacy, then it's making a serious mistake. I've made no secret of my dislike for Facebook's privacy overhaul, and while there's been plenty of articles questioning Facebook's motivations, I think we're yet to really see the true backlash begin. This is just the tip of the iceberg. So, he says that he didn't say to lie there, but you can put in Atlantis or Valhalla for your city, which is lying, because those places don't exist. And in their policy, it says you can't provide false information or you get kicked off. So which is it? You can lie or you can't lie. So in a desperate attempt to keep people from flooding away from Facebook after the recent privacy fiasco they're having, where even the Facebook founder, Mark Zuckerberg, had his private pictures exposed briefly before he hid them away again, they're now telling customers to go against their privacy policies, which they could be kicked off for. So I'm not sure which side of the mouth that we should believe that they're talking out of. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see if people start putting in false cities and getting kicked off of Facebook and see the backlash that comes from that. Next story, copyright news from the U.S. trying to add portability to movie files. It's from NewYorkTimes.com. Now, there's a lot of corporate speak in this next story because it looks like it was released from a corporate paper, but so just bear with the story. It's a little hard to stomach some of the words and phrases that they're using here. It's easy to take a DVD to a friend's house and watch it on his TV, but things are more complicated when digital video downloads are involved. A movie file brought from Blockbuster will not work on a Sony HD TV, for example, and videos from the iTunes work only on devices with Apple software. At the Consumer Electronics Show, a big high-tech gathering that will begin Wednesday in Las Vegas, so yesterday, Hollywood studios and consumer electronics makers plan to lay out some of the steps they're taking to simplify this digital future, perhaps stem the worrying decline in home entertainment sales. Hollywood and its high-tech partners are deeply concerned that their customers will rebel against some of the limitations taking shape as video moves away from physical discs. Consumers, the industry believes, could balk at buying digital movies and TV shows until they can bring their collections with them wherever they go. By and large, the same freedom people have with DVDs. In the last year and a half, a broad alliance of high-tech companies and Hollywood studios have been trying to address this problem through an organization called Digital Entertainment Content Ecosystem, or DECE. Five of the six major Hollywood studios, Warner Brothers, NBC Universal, Sony, Paramount and Fox, but not Walt Disney, are involved with Microsoft, Cisco Systems, Comcast, Intel, and Best Buy. The group is setting out to create a common digital standard. I have to stop at that. This standard, I always laugh at this when they say, we want to make a standard. No, they don't want to make a standard. They want everybody to buy in to what they're doing. And that is why you can see that Walt Disney's not part of it. But I think we get to that later on in the story. It's not a standard. If it was a standard that everybody could use, they wouldn't ask for money to apply for this standard. Anyway, I digress. That would let consumers buy or rent a digital video once and then play it on any device. It might sound technical, but it could be crucial to persuading customers to buy all the splashy new internet-connected gear that tech companies will demonstrate at CES, like HDTVs and set-top boxes that can download TV shows and films. Under the proposed system, proof of digital purchases would be stored online in a so-called rights locker, and consumers would be permitted to play the movies they bought or rented on any Deci compatible device. So, for example, business travelers might find that their hotel room television could tap into their personal movie collections. Consumers could buy Blu-ray discs and have digital copies of those films accessible from all their devices, even their mobile phones. And a PC maker could customize a new laptop for buyers by loading it with all their movies and shows, and eventually their video games and ebooks. These advances may not be all that far off. On Monday, the Digital Content Organization plans to announce several moves that signal that it's ready for companies to start building devices and services with the technology this year. Industry observers expected such an announcement last year. The group is announcing that it has adopted a new file format, like the DVD, will allow any company to create a compatible digital, compatible device or digital video store. It is also selecting Newstar, a company based in Sterling, Virginia, to create the online hub that will store records of people's digital purchases with their permission. The group is also announcing 21 new members, pushing the effort even further towards cross-industry unity. The new companies include consumer devices makers like Samsung Electronics, Nokia, and Motorola, entertainment retailers like Netflix and European chain Tesco, and the cable companies Cox Communications and Liberty Global. Disney is still a holdout. It is advocating a similar plan called KeyChest, which analysts say it may introduce working with Apple. A Disney spokesman said that the company would give an early look at its rival technology at CES. The Deci says that it's further along and the technical specifications of its system will be available to other companies in the next few months. Devices and services could be available to consumers as early as next year. There were many skeptics out there who believed that with so many companies we could never achieve anything, said Mitch Singer, the president of Deci and chief technology officer of Sony Pictures Entertainment. We've actually achieved almost everything. But the effort is still a long way to go before it can claim anything like success. The proof will be whether it revives home entertainment sales by getting consumers excited about the new freedoms of the digital world. Hollywood needs consumers to buy more digital content. DVD and Blu-ray revenues can contribute significantly to Hollywood's bottom line, but spending on those discs has dropped sharply. It declined 3.2% to $4 billion in the third quarter of last year. Digital sales were up nearly 20% in the quarter, but amounted to a relatively paltry $420 million. And movie studios can only guess how much revenue is lost to piracy, which they say tends to grow at the speed of the internet access increases. Now, I want to stop it there. I didn't report on this story this week, but the overall spending on movies overall in the U.S. has stayed steady from 2008 to 2009, whereas the DVDs and Blu-rays has declined, people going to the movies has increased, and the overall spending is exactly the same. And I'll continue. And the movie studios get blah, blah, blah. Hollywood also wants to avoid having a single company like Apple enticing people to buy only from its own closed digital system. And I'll put in quotes, we just want people to buy from our closed digital system instead. I'll continue. And ending up with an inordinate degree of control over matters like pricing. Movie executives shudder at the power of Apple accumulated over the music's labels with iTunes, and influence on Amazon appears to be gathering over publishers with ebooks. The possibility is there for a single player to completely dominate the economics, says Bill Rosenblatt, president of Giant Steps Media Technology Strategies, a consulting firm. Hollywood runs the risk of being held up and surpassed by powerful entities going it alone. He said, adding that Amazon shown signs of doing just that with its introduction last month of Disc on Demand, a service that lets consumers who buy certain DVDs and Blu-ray discs view the same titles on demand at no additional cost. Oh my goodness, an opponent to our plan, which is exactly the same. There is also a possibility that the Deci is making a flawed bet on the direction of technology and emerging consumer habits. Its system is primarily aimed at getting people to buy and own digital copies of the film, in the same way people collected VHS cassettes and DVDs. But an increasing number of web services allow people to more cheaply stream movies and shows without ever permanently storing a copy. The the Decky says its technology can accommodate streaming, allowing members of a family, for example, to watch the same movie at the same time in different locations. But it's not clear that such a rights scheme is necessarily in a purely on-demand watch-it-once world. The market desperately needs this, but in some senses, it's already moving past it towards a rental of content over ownership, said Danielle Levitas, an analyst at IDC. Ms. Levitas also said that Decky's progress has been slower than she expected. I wanted to see these devices in the market already announced by CES. Mr. Singer acknowledges that every single company knows that the time is not their friend right now. But he says to truly spark the digital media revolution, the industry must embed its technology so deeply in the digital services and devices that consumers will not even notice it, so that getting access to the digital content is easy as bringing a DVD to a friend's house. Consumers shouldn't have to know what's inside, he said. They should just know that it will play. So, how do you feel about the potential future loss of physical media as they move towards locking it up in even what they're calling lockers, where they hold your access to your media that you have given them money for, as opposed to having the physical disc of a DVD that you can take anywhere you want and play at anybody's house? And even the DVDs were not a great solution, because you couldn't change a DVD without violating the DMCA and Copyright Act, in effect, by putting it on a portable device. And so do you feel threatened by the proposals of the media corporations to grant licenses to view the media where they keep movies stored on their side? Or do you feel it would add more portability and ease between the hardware platforms? So their proposal really is to license all the pieces of hardware out there, which of course they'd have to, these hardware manufacturers would have to pay the license for getting this Decky or DC, not sure how it's pronounced, not an easy acronym there, DECE, on all of these devices, so that your Windows would have to log in and your Mac would have to log into this locker and be online. Like, if you were offline, you can't watch this. If you're out in the woods, you want to watch a DVD, you can't do it. You would have to be online to ask permission. Maybe they'll set up something that will grant you a magic 24-hour window where, oh, I'm going to go somewhere where there's no internet connection. Please, 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 can I watch my movie in 24 hours? Because I won't be able to ask your permission to watch my movie, because I'm going to be out of your range of your ears, so you can't hear me begging for permission to watch media that I've paid for. I feel that they're trying to overcomplicate things. There are already many formats out there, such as AVI and MKV and MP3s and AACs, that have proven very portable, that you can play on many, many devices, and is streamable. And I've streamed over my internal network from one computer to another without asking permission of anybody, of DVDs that I've bought and ripped, so it's easy to access right on a hard drive. And it's easy to even transfer to a portable drive or a thumb drive and take it to somebody else's house, my friend's house, if I want to watch it there. Or listen to music there, or take it into my car and put it on my hard drive in my computer. And they could just save all this money on research and development and pass the savings on to the consumer by just putting out new products in these already available DRM-free formats that people are embracing on the internet and sharing files with on the torrent sites. It's already established. It's already out there. It looks great. It sounds great. There's nothing wrong with these formats. So you don't have to worry about, also, you don't have to worry about the ongoing cost of maintaining servers to verify ownership, because there's many open source options out there for already licensing and containing your video formats and audio formats. You don't have to pay somebody to license that. And eventually, what if these places shut down and you can't watch your movie anymore? Are they going to guarantee that they're going to give you a free, perfect perfect copy of your movie that you've bought from them after their servers shut down because they're going out of business? Very unlikely. And then you're going to have to buy the same movie over again from the person who has bought out the rights or still owns the rights to that movie that you like. And so there's also extremely inexpensive methods of distribution out there. They don't have to set up servers and dedicate a whole bunch of bandwidth to distributing movies and asking permission because there's already BitTorrent out there. BitTorrent works very well, and people are embracing it, as shown by a lot of these torrent sites. Why don't they embrace it and use this to their advantage for distribution of their movies and music? End rant. Copyright news from Finland. Record label stops signing artists because of piracy. This is sent in by DC from torrentfreak.com. The Finnish record label Lion Music has announced that it will not sign any new musicians until politicians have managed to stop piracy. Well, I guess it's over for them because there's real no way to stop piracy. Illegal downloading is killing music, they say, and the label has rallied up its rock stars to spread the word. Let's be clear from the start. People who share music on the internet actually buy more than those who don't. The music library of the average music fan has expanded a bit in the last decade thanks to file sharing. But in the same time, the number of sales have always also skyrocketed. Despite this, there will also be labels that perform badly for unrelated reasons. How convenient is it then to blame evil file sharings for your disappointing results? Finnish hard rock label Lion Music is doing just that with dramatic consequences. Because of all the stealing and looting by internet pirates, the label has decided to not sign any new acts until politicians have found a remedy. We are not able to sign more artists. No demos or masters you send to us will be considered for release. We will not listen to any MP3 files or check out your websites, and we will not respond to questions regarding releasing your album. The label's bosses write on their website. The illegal file sharing on the net is killing independent music. We are sorry about this situation, but we are sure you are aware of what is going on. The dramatic rant continues. Our demo policy will not change before our politicians have stopped the P2P sites. Illegal file sharing is not just about stealing from rich companies, major companies. It is about killing independent music and making it impossible for many great musicians to have a chance to release albums and have a musical career, even as a part-time job. Next time you consider downloading an album for free or adding new torrents, please think of your impact you're having on the artists. Would you like it if we came to your house and stole your paycheck? The label's bosses then go on to show various statistics of how many times the albums of their artists were pirated through an unnamed BitTorrent site, arguing that those downloads are responsible for their disappointing results. To add to the drama, the label has asked the musicians to write up their thoughts on a piracy in a section called The Murder of Music. One of the artists who penned up his thoughts on piracy is guitar hero Borislav Mittik. Mittik is just as gentle in his commentary as the label's bosses. Just because you can download music for free on the internet doesn't mean you should, he writes. You can also beat up an old lady on the street and steal her pension from her wallet. But somebody can beat you up too and do the same to you. Would you like this? According to Borislav, illegal downloading will lead to a society of filthy wild savages. To those people who dare to continue stealing through BitTorrent site ads, the blood will be on your hands. Those who have the courage to read the rest of the artist entries will be amazed at the hostile tone towards readers who assume they are pirates. Don't get us wrong, despite research that points in the opposite direction, it could be that piracy is hurting the sales of Lion Music. But even if this was true, their way of bringing the message across is not going to help their cause. It will only alienate the fans. A label taking completely the opposite stance, embracing both file sharers and their fans, is Thorny Bleeder Records, who have just released the second volume of their free download series. Entitled Get Thorny 2, the album features new music from 17 independent Canadian artists. And now, in Pirate Party news, the PPC is now an official NPC. So now if you don't know what those acronyms mean, this is from the Pirate Party of Canada. We're kicking off the year with exciting news. The PPCA is officially recognized as a non-profit corporation, NPC. Simply put, that means we'll be able to finally start working with donations and work with PayPal to get the pending funds. Look for bright investments for your favorite political party sometimes in the near future. So this is one more step closer to becoming an official, federally recognized political party in Canada. So congratulations to the Pirate Party of Canada for taking that next step in getting closer to being a political party. And for the closing words, I was sent this by Legion Rosenman. It's a short snippet from WikiLeaks talking about an offshore publication idea that is very brilliant. You can check out the link to the hour-long talk they gave last week on the Pirate Party Radio Forum. And it's called WikiLeaks of the Next Generation and Future Opportunities. So I'll link that up in the forum so you can get to it. So if you have any news stories you'd like to hear or questions or comments, just head over to the PiratePartyRadio.com site and submit them through the forum. Thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
For now, it's not entirely clear if we can bring across this whole idea here within this short talk, but this is a very, very serious idea. I want to have that said. It's not just spontaneous, and there's a lot of momentum behind it already, and anyone who feels that what we're trying to introduce here is interesting should talk to us afterwards, because we need a lot of people, and there's only a small window of opportunity to do something like this. So, okay, but what is the Offshore Publication Center? So it would provide a specialized set of laws, same as the Finance Center. So we could just say we're taking the source protection laws from Sweden, for example, that exist. They are proven laws accepted by society as established in a country. We could take the First Amendment from the United States. We could take Belgium protection laws for journalists. And we could all pack these together in one bundle and make it fit for the first jurisdiction that offers the necessities of an information society. Everyone in this room should understand that all of these freedoms in respect to information are really at stake at the moment. These people are upgrading all the time. They are going from nation states to Europe, and it's going international, and we have the ACTA stuff and whatnot, and they're trying to get to our information on all possible ways. So we thought we just have to upgrade as well, maybe, and go from the defense to the attack and create something that is fit, create a Switzerland of bits.
Just finish that up.